So far, we've looked at the apologetic questions regarding the person and work of Jesus because we started off near Easter. And so we've had, can you prove that Jesus was a real person? Why do Christians go on so much about Jesus' death? And then last week, isn't it a myth that Jesus rose from the dead? Today, we take a different line. We go really back to the start of the book by, if I can find it here, by Brad Emery. This book, and for those, there's a couple of people interested in purchasing them. I have three left, $20 each, if you want to purchase one of them. See me after the service. But today we're asking the question, hasn't science proven that God doesn't exist? Well, for me, the answer is no. And let me say that from the start, that in 2009, so a few years ago, but not too many, a survey was completed by American scientists in which 51% of them said that they believed in the existence of a higher power and that a third of all of them believed in the God that we find in the Bible. I suspect that the stats in Australia would be less than that because we're in some ways, a less Christian nation, sort of, than America. Americans, we see the movie stars doing all sorts of things, but they go to church, don't they? And they call themselves Christian. So I suspect that the stats would be lower in Australia. Mind you, in Brad Emery's children's book, his question is, hey, God, did you really create the people, the world, the galaxy, and everything? And so today we'll look at the universe and to where God does or does not fit into it. But as we begin looking particularly at the science and at the universe, I want to ask you a question. And it's a question which you'll put up your hand. There are three choices, and you might wait till the end or you might not. It's better if you answer when they come up, because then I can say, yeah, so many people. It's about climate change. Very controversial in our time, isn't it? So put up your hand if you believe that there is climate change and that this climate change has come about as a result of human activity. So around half, more than half. So put your hands down, thank you. Put up your hand if you believe that there is climate change, but that what we do as humans doesn't really play a significant role when it comes to climate change. Yeah, a smaller percentage. And a lot of people go that way, like the volcano that went off in Bali, didn't it? Like so much. Final question is that you put up your hand if you don't believe in climate change at all, for you believe that we're just going through another normal cycle. So it's good to have brave people there because it can be something that you get condemned for. When one of the political parties was meeting here recently, they had a speaker speaking on the second option, and they were trying to convert me the whole time and responding that way. But when you look at that science, the science of climate change, we see that there's a diversity of opinions even within our congregation, isn't it? We're not all on the same page. We've all got our own opinions. And our personal view on climate change is influenced by many things. One of those is the facts that we've investigated or heard reported to us. Or there's our own personal experiences. I'm not saying where I stand on this. I didn't put my hand up. I'm still probably not too sure. But when I went to Franz Josef Glacier, when my parents went there, they just walked down at the end of the path onto the glacier. When I went there, the glacier was 4 kilometres away, and there's no way you're allowed to walk there. That's a big change in that. So that's an experience. But there's also the media, what the media says. But the thing is that all of us listen to different media, different newses. And so people your own age might listen to a very different news to you, and people younger than you or older than you might do so as well. So what media we watch and what they tell us. Another thing is on how old we are. Do we really want to pay more for power bills now to try to restrict when I only got a few years to live? And so how old we are or what our children or our grandchildren may say to us. One of the problems with climate change is that we have scientists who argue in favour of each of those three positions on the screen. And truth be told, we don't know for sure which scientists are right. Why is that? Isn't that true? It'll only be with the benefit of hindsight that we'll be able to know for certain which scientists were right, and by then most of us will be dead. But our grandchildren may not be. Same is true when it comes to answering a question like, does science prove that God does not exist? If you ask me, I'll answer you, absolutely. God, the God of the Bible, does exist. For as I look at the evidence, for example, as I look at the order in which this world operates, one simple example, I often talk about the human eye. That's the eye of an eagle. What can an eagle do with its little eye? It can see fish miles away and stuff like that. Can look in the sun, apparently. So it's amazing what one little eye of one little minor animal on earth can do. And so the only explanation that I can come up with as a person with a scientific background, I did 2 years of uni. I did organic and inorganic chemistry. Whether I passed them, I'm not too sure. I did very well in the pracs in chemistry. But I did 2 years, and that was where I got my marks in my HSC. But with my scientific background, I believe that there must be a being that designed our world and our universe, and that this being is the God I find in the Bible. For through God's creation, I get a glimpse of God's magnificence and really the miracle of our existence. And through creation, I see that this God, this being, must deeply care for us as humans. It all revolves around us, the whole universe. For this being has designed this world so that we might thrive. And then that said, I can't prove to you or to anyone else that God does exist, because none of us can bring God out of the cupboard and say, here he is, have a look. But that day will come. For me, the God I find in the Bible is the real deal. And I guess what you're seeing me do today is a bit of my apologetics for my position on these matters. And I know that within this room, there are people with very different opinions on some of what I will say. But I see the God I find in the Bible as the real deal and really the only true option. But my experiences also tell me that the God of the Bible is the God whom I'm to worship. I have experienced the love of God. I have experienced God's leading. I've experienced God speaking to me on at least two occasions. I've experienced God performing miracles around me and even within me. Finally, I've experienced God's power when it comes to being confronted with evil. But can I prove to you that God exists? No, I can't. Rather, I have faith. But it's not blind faith, it's based on the evidence and on my experiences that God does exist and that this same God loves me so much he sent his own son to save me. But until God reveals himself to all, which he will one day, the existence of God is like the existence of climate change. For only with the benefit of hindsight will we be able to prove that our God does exist, but by then, for many, it'll be too late. For until then, the existence of God, like the existence of climate change, is only a theory to many, not a fact. Now, today, as we look at the question, does God exist, we're going to spend some time focusing on the difference between scientific theory and scientific fact, because I think sometimes we get a bit confused by that. So firstly, what is scientific fact? Well, go to Google AI, you'll come up with this answer. And I think it's pretty good. It states the scientific fact is an observation, a measurement, or a piece of data that has been repeatedly, and that's important, confirmed through testing and observation, and is accepted as the true for all practical purposes. So scientific facts are empirical. They are reliable, but they can be subject to change or refinement if new, more accurate evidence emerges. Now, whilst my degrees and masters are in theology and biblical studies, my background was in chemistry and maths, and so I know that if I combine various chemicals, and I used to do this for a job, when I combine them at a certain temperature under a certain pressure, I will come up with the same result each and every time. But many of you here are also chemists, particularly the women. Because who here has ever made chocolate fudge? You? Not confident hands. I wonder why they're not confident hands. Well, Melody's got a confident hand. So, tell me the ingredients of basic chocolate fudge. Chocolate cocoa, but yeah, cocoa. Butter. Sugar. Cream or milk. Yep. And salt. Five. And it's very easy to get those quantities right, isn't it? We've got wonderful little devices at home that enable us to measure them. So we can get the right proportion each and every time, but for those who've made it, what's difficult about making fudge? Where'd that come? Temperature, that's right, and the length of time, isn't it? That's very critical. So you can have the temperature, but cook it too long or cook it too short. And if you do that, you come up with stuff that's better on ice cream. Melita went yum, but she actually likes this one. They call it tablet in New Zealand, but I think that might be Scotland. So it's a grainy sort of a fudge. So it's very easy to muck up fudge. And if it's easy to muck up fudge, imagine how easy it'd be to muck up making a human being. Like, seriously. Let me ask you another question. At what exact temperature does water boil? 100 degrees. Any advancements? Depends on the altitude. Oh, there you go. So, for those who likes their tea really hot, some of you on the top of Mount Kosciuszko, you won't be able to get a good cup of tea because water boils at 93 degrees. And so, if you're camping, you've got light stuff like rice. Rice will take a lot longer to cook because it's cooking at 93 degrees. But there's a formula which Graham was sort of alluding to for calculating the boiling temperature of water. There it is, or one of them. Can you see it up the top? A bit of clues there. It's a fairly simple formula. But can you see the squiggly lines there? There. That's because it's not very exact. So if you want to work out the exact temperature, firstly, you've got to work out the exact atmospheric pressure at that altitude using a formula like this one, because there's a couple of different options. And then you need to plug, and this is what I used to do at uni, you see, and at schooling. Then you need to plug it into another formula to come up with the temperature. And then you pretty well get the exact temperature of which water will boil at that altitude. You got all that? But it's consistent, it's empirical, it's reliable. And it points to an order in our world, a constant order. And this order, at least for me, reveals that there is something that gave this world such a constant order and had a reason for doing this. And that this incredible, amazing thing is what we Christians call God. For we believe that the God that we find in the Bible created and sustains everything that there is. And Paul talks about this in Romans chapter 1, doesn't he? He says, what may be known about God is plain to us. Well, to an extent, we know he's magnificent. We know he knows much, much more than we do, et cetera, et cetera. He goes on to write, because God has made it plain to us. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, so his eternal power and his divine nature, writes Paul, have been clearly seen so that people are without excuse. All people. John Chrysostom wrote in the 5th century AD, God placed creation itself before our eyes. Why? So, in this way, whether you're educated or uneducated, you can rise up to God, learning through the loveliness of the things that we see. King David put it much easier, I think, in Psalm 19. The heavens declare or display the glory of God. And they do. It's been a marvelous week for stars this week. I don't know if my eyesight's getting better or what. And you just think about the universe, and anyone who's been looking at the stars this week, I've got an app that does it over that direction. Something like six planets are aligned at the moment. Six of our planets in the solar system. Quite amazing. Not that the world not that the universe revolves around us, of course. Our solar system revolves around the sun. But we know, don't we? We know that the sun will rise tomorrow. We've made plans for tomorrow based on the assumption that the sun will rise. We know that it got a bit cold this week because what's on its way? Winter. And the trees know it's autumn, don't they? Our car park's filling up with leaves. And this happens over and over and over and over and over and over and again. And we can depend on it. We can put our tulips in the ground, not here. We need to put them in the freezer here, our bulbs, but in other countries, so they will come up naturally based on what the order that God has set. And so scientific facts and the formulas that we use to try to explain them, they work each and every time if we get them right. And it is these facts that prove, at least to me, that there must be a being, a God, who created all this. Whereas a scientific theory is something quite different. Again, from AI, scientific theory is a well-substantiated, comprehensive explanation of some aspect of the natural world based on a body of facts, laws, and tested hypotheses. So, give me a couple of examples of well-known scientific theories. Can't hear any. There's something called, gravity's a fact, so not really. There's a TV show called The Big Bang Theory. And then Darwin came up with something, he called it the evolutionary theory. And you see, there's a difference between a theory and a fact. And it's probably here where some of you are going to go, Alan's just crazy. Or you'll go, no, I agree with that. That's what I was taught. That's what I've always known, though I'm a bit hard, not really going to say it. It's not a salvation issue, but it's good to look at theory and fact. So, scientific theory isn't just a hunch. You know, we get hunches. It's not a hunch. It's more than that. There is information that goes into it, but they can predict or try to predict new observations. Trouble is that some people look at evolutionary theory, for example, as a means of proving that God doesn't exist or doesn't need to exist because we've just come into existence by nature. Now, when it comes to evolutionary theory, carbon dating is one of the main methods that's used to support the theory when it comes to dating particularly organic material like human bones. But then, is carbon dating a scientific fact or is it a scientific theory? Trick question, it's a scientific method. And for, as I said, carbon dating, it's a method based on facts in both physics and chemistry, but it's got some shortcomings. It's believed to be highly reliable, but it also includes certain, they call it interpretive steps. That's open to interpretation, that sometimes require calibration or even recalibration. Now, it's these interpretations and recalibrations that mean that carbon dating isn't always reliable. Because who was around 300 million years ago to say such and such existed in the way that they say it existed? I wasn't. But also errors can occur when it comes to dating something using carbon dating. These errors come firstly through contamination, particularly with marine fossils, because the marine are consuming things much older than themselves. So it's hard to date marine fossils, and a lot of the fossil evidence for evolution is based on marine fossils. Another common error occurs in carbon dating, because carbon dating relies on assumptions not facts about past atmospheric carbon levels. Do you know what the carbon levels were like in the atmosphere 300,000 years ago? I don't, but we're making assumptions and using science to make those assumptions. They might be right, but they could be quite wrong. Putting it simply, and it gets a little bit confusing here if you're not confused already, radiocarbon dating doesn't work well on objects that are 20,000 years old or more. It's what we use to date organic materials, but they don't work well on 20,000 years or more. Why is not? Why is that? Well, because there's so little carbon 14 left that the beta ray radiation is swamped out by the background radiation of cosmic rays and potassium 40. What's that mean? I don't know 100%. I'm pretty sure on the carbon 14 stuff, that means that carbon deteriorates. It's not much left to work on. Another quote said that carbon dating was good for dating organic materials up to 50,000 years. So that's good, but it's not a silver bullet, is the quote. But then if these are the facts, then how can carbon dating be used to work out how many millions of years or hundreds of thousands of years old something is? Well, it can't, can it? Interpretation, recalibration. Scientists do use other, I'd call them less accurate dating methods for things that are considered to be hundreds of thousands of years old and millions of years old, and you can look them up. Now, in giving an example on this, I wanted to admit to you that I might be on the wrong path here, but I want to give you an example of how interpretation and recalibration has been used in my lifetime for carbon dating to describe how long Aboriginal Australians have been a culture. When I was growing up, I was told Aboriginal Australians were thought to have been around for about 6,000 years. 20 years ago, when I arrived in the diocese, it's just nothing to do with the diocese, the figure was 10 times that, 65,000 years, making Australian Aboriginal culture considered to be the oldest enduring culture in the world because it hasn't changed much. That's certainly in a village type environment. But then in the last couple of years, this figure has, did you notice? It's doubled. It's gone to 150,000 years. How did we go from 65,000 years to 150,000 years? Interpretation, recalibration. So how's it changed so much? Well, the dating, is it a scientific fact, the dating? Is it a scientific theory? Is it a scientific hypothesis? Or is the dating of Aboriginal culture based on something that has nothing to do with science? Maybe political science. Not trying to be mean there or anything there, but just how does it change? Now, I think it's hard for us to put a date on how long the human race has been around. For if people won't accept the huge amount of evidence for the existence of Jesus, that he lived, died, and rose again 2,000 years ago, how could we ever hope to try to explain what happened 150,000 years ago? In fact, the internet tells me that we humans have been around for 300,000 years and that the missing links, subhumans, were around somewhere between 2 and 6 million years ago. That's a big gap, isn't it? 4 million years. How good is carbon dating for organic materials? When's it reliable? 20,000, 50,000 years, say 50,000. How do you do 2 to 6 million years? What seems to happen is that the numbers keep getting recalibrated, and you can look up some stuff that talks about that. A few months ago in one of my sermons, I probably got the most response out of any sermon I'd ever had from a group of people. I made the comment that this world is at least 6,000 years old. Is that true? Yeah, it's true, but boy, did I cop it for that. During morning tea, I had the most interaction, as I said, with people over this comment. I wasn't saying that the world is 6,000 years old. But I was saying that the world, or at least humans, have been around for at least 6,000 years. In fact, with my scientific background, I'm more supportive of the human race being around for tens of thousands of years than for hundreds of thousands of years. And so when you need listen to speakers, you know, what's their background? Are they a lawyer? Well, what science did they study? It's amazing who speaks these things. Let me give you some of the reasons why I err this way in looking at the Earth, at humans being around for tens of thousands of years rather than hundreds of thousands of years, and I hope you don't stone me. When it comes to the length of human existence, there are many things that for me point to humans being around for less than 20,000 years. An example of this is that one of the oldest cities, where are we going here? One of the oldest, or the oldest inhabited city in the world, is around 6 to 10,000 years old. And this is the biblical city of Jericho, located on the West Bank in Israel. And it's widely recognized as being the oldest inhabited city. They date its initial settlement, so when people started wandering around there, not building cities, to around 9,000 BC. But it's not alone. There's Plovdiv in Bulgaria. Anyone be there? Don't know where Bulgaria is. Dates to 6,000 BC. Aleppo, Syria. Anyone been there? It's an amazing looking thing, isn't it? Dates to around 5,000 BC, 7,000 years. Finally, Byblos in Lebanon. It looks older, doesn't it? But, you know, you go around Israel, there's many places look like that. It dates to dates back around 7,000 to 9,000 years. So whilst these cities are widely considered to be older than 6,000 years, it's nothing like 300,000 years, is it, that humans are said to have been around? More importantly, this date of 300,000 years isn't consistent with the God that we find in the Bible, or what we read in the Bible. And that's where it comes a Christian, where our science meets the Bible and we have the issues, isn't it? When it comes to the Bible, in Genesis we read that the first humans were Adam and Eve, and that they had a couple of sons to start with whose names were Cain and Abel. Genesis chapter 4, verse 17, of course, Cain kills Abel, the Bible account gives. But Genesis chapter 4, verse 17, we read that Cain built something. He built a city. Cain built a city. So then you get the genealogy from Genesis chapter 5, and we see that this city was built within 130 years of Adam and Eve being created by God. That's literal looking at this. But it's interesting to look at the literal mathematics of that dating of those genealogies. Because put it on a timeline and see what God shows you. He'll show you a few things on that. But anyway. Now, of course, some people argue, and they might be right, that many of the generations are missed out. But, of course, there's a huge difference, isn't there, between 6,000 years and 300,000 years. Huge difference. But still, I can live with that if I need to. But I do struggle with the claims made by evolutionary theorists. I struggle, firstly, because of the millions of years that they suggest. Secondly, because of the almost total lack of missing links of transitional fossils in the fossil record. Some argue the opposite, though. They say there's heaps. But have you seen any missing links wandering around lately? Why not? Why did they have to die off? What changed so dramatically? Thirdly, because of the scientific concept of entropy. I know it's for thermodynamics, but it does apply to the other sciences. Entropy says that rather than us evolving into something more sophisticated, we should be becoming something more and more disordered, which is what I observe when I look at the Earth. I don't know about you. Dust doesn't clean itself up. It continues to, things continue to become more disordered. And finally, because if we humans have been around for 300,000 years and if evolution works, then shouldn't we see some humans evolving? Yes, some of our footy players are getting bigger, aren't they? My nephews, both my brother-in-law and sister are shorter than me. My nephews are up here. Better diet. Same's happening in Japan. But that's not evolution. Not at all. Evolution is, well, we actually get a bigger ear or something physically different about us, radically physically different, because we're evolving into something better. It doesn't seem to happen. We seem to be having, I don't know, are we having more deformities? I don't know. Interesting questions. But my main problem, of course, with evolutionary theory is that if we evolved over the last 2 to 6 million years, are we then all descended from Adam and Eve? Or were there multiple Adam and Eves in different places in the world who evolved and appeared roughly around the same time 300,000 years ago? I can't even imagine the odds of doing that. I wouldn't want to bet on that. That'd be worse than our lotto. And another thing for me is, if we have evolved, when did the first human death occur? Does that matter? Does that matter to us as Christians of when the first human death occurred? For if we're not all descended from Adam and Eve, then I've got a problem with what the Bible says. But Jesus referred to Adam and Eve when he argued for God's design for marriage, that from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female, and that they became one flesh. Jesus also referred to the blood of Abel, the one who Cain killed, in Luke 11, 50 to 51. And this indicates that Jesus treated Abel, and I suspect Adam and Eve, as historical figures. Now, Paul is not Jesus, but it's what Paul writes in Romans that causes me to say that humans are not evolved, but rather we're all descended, we are created for a purpose, and that we're all descended from Adam and Eve. Paul writes in Romans chapter 5, sin entered the world through one man. He names this man as being Adam. And death came through sin. How did the first humans die? Bible says sin. And so now all die, writes Paul. But as Paul goes on to write, if the many died by the trespass of the one man, so Adam, how much more did God's grace and the gift that came by the grace of the one man, Jesus Christ, overflow to the many? Whereas Paul writes more simply in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, in Adam all die, and in Christ all will be made alive. And so here we see that, like Jesus, Paul referred to Adam and Eve as being literal people. So we may have to ask ourselves, do I believe the Bible's true? When's it start becoming true? Was there a literal Adam? Was there a literal Eve? Did death come as a result of human sin? For if death didn't come as a result of human sin, then why the heck would Jesus have to come? Why the heck would he have to die on the cross to save me? They're big questions for me. They're things I can't put away. They are too deeply ingrained, too essential to my hope, to my faith, to my experience, to my facts. If Jesus' death achieved nothing. Now, they may be hard questions for us to answer, but for me, the questions that need to be answered by evolutionary theorists are far, far harder. For I see natural evolution as being impossible. Whereas for me, based on the reliability of the Bible, the documents, the historical facts, the scientific facts, my own personal experiences. I have very good reasons for believing that Adam and Eve were the first humans created by God in his image from the dust. Doesn't mean I'm right. It's not a salvation issue here. Doesn't mean I'm right. I could be wrong. Many Christian scientists support the theory of evolution. But they say that God was behind it. And so whilst I can accept that God may have taken many, many years to create the world and the universe and all its creatures, you know, my God is so powerful, the eagle's eye, and then we're one tiny little universe in multiple, multiple universes. He's so powerful that he could have created everything from a formless void in very much less time than what some of the scientists think. Well, I put myself out there today, left myself open to questions. I may not be able to answer your scientific questions, but if you want to ask a question, here's your opportunity. Trevor. Yeah, so that's a question that Rachel gets asked regularly, I assume. So if there was only an Adam and Eve and they had kids, is that ultimately saying, were the children having incest? And there's a lot to that question, and it's a good question. But a very different human, like, genetics were very different back then, wasn't it? And we didn't come up with a concept of not having sex with children, with sisters and brothers until the law came in, did we? The law comes in under Moses some however many thousands of years later and says, no, you shall not have sex with your brother and sister. Before that, there was no law. And we see Abraham and Sarah, don't we? What were they? Brother and sister, different mother. And he's the father of faith. So it's not really a disproving, it shows how things evolved in the Bible, and there's a lot more to it. Anyway. So, but it's something that people argue, and they're the sort of questions you get, isn't it? They're the sort of questions that may come to you, because we are put off by that. We are put off by, why would Jesus have to be sacrificed? Trouble was, 2,000 years ago, everybody's sacrificing animals and peoples and everything else and having sex with temple prostitutes to try to appease God. But things have changed since 2,000 years ago because we have a Saviour who came and died to save us. So you've got to live in your context, but consider the context of other times. Now, thanks for the question. You're the first person who's been game to ask a question. And Sarah's got one. That's more worrying. Yeah. Like, so did you hear what Sarah said? So Adam, was it Adam or lived 800 years after Seth was born, the third born? How often could you, and this is before sin came into the world, if we take that literally, how often could a woman be having children if no contraceptives? How often? Every 12 months? The health? 830 years? How many kids is that? And then you might have some twins and triplets. It's worthwhile looking at those figures and just seeing how they add up. Yeah. But certainly, yeah. So you don't have to have a literal Adam and Eve. I struggle if there's not. I do struggle. I had a fellow that he was, what was he? A geologist. What do geologists do? Study rocks. And what do they primarily do about rocks? They study the age. Now, he was in the outback. He was a six-day creationist. He was a rational man. How could he do that based on what others tell us? Sarah. So God is outside of our time. He is far more powerful than we are. And that's what we're going to hear in our last Bible reading, well, our only Bible reading. We haven't had a Bible reading yet, have we? There's a guy called Job. Anyone heard of Job? He was a righteous man, and he went through a hard time. He was tested by the devil, really, because the devil challenged God. In the end, everything was taken away from Job. He was filled with sores. All he did was scratch himself all day. And then his mates came along to support him, and they just tore him apart and accused him of sinning. Eventually, he had a gutful, and he said, God, come here, and I'll tell you what's what. I'll ask you these questions and see what you've got to say. He's a righteous man, not an unrighteous man, asking God these questions. So let's hear, firstly, how God responds. And you might get surprised how God responds. And then hear what Job then says in response. Thank you, Graham.
Well, the reading is from Job 38, verse 1 to 21, and 42, verse 1 to 7. Then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm. He said, who is this that obscures my plans with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me, if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? On what were its footing set? For who laid its cornerstone? While the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy. Who shut up the sea behind doors when it burst forth from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness? When I fixed limits for it and set its doors and bars in place? When I said, this far you may come and no farther, here is where your proud waves halt. Have you ever given orders to the morning or shown the dawn its place that it might take the earth by the edges and shake the wicked out of it? The earth takes shape like clay under a seal. Its features stand out like those of a garment. The wicked are denied their light and their upraised arm is broken. Have you journeyed to the springs of the sea? Or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been shown to you? Have you seen the gates of the deepest darkness? Have you comprehended the vast expanses of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. What is the way to the abode of light, and where does darkness reside? Can you take them to their places? Do you know the paths up to their dwellings? Surely you know, for you were already born, and you have lived so many years. Then Job replied, I know that you can do all things. No purpose of yours can be thwarted. You asked, who is this that obscures my plans without knowledge? Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. You said, listen now, and I will speak. I will question you, and you shall answer me. My ears had heard of you, but my eyes have now seen you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. After the Lord had said these things to Job, he said to Eliphaz the Temanite, I am angry with you and your two friends because you have not spoken the truth about me, as my servant Job has. This is the word of the Lord.
Did you know that God could be sarcastic? Imagine the fear. You've asked me questions. I'm going to ask you questions, and then I'm going to make you answer me. And really, that's the picture of God's judgment on Judgment Day, isn't it? And that's why it's so important to see that last verse. I was tossing up with Bill whether we had it. But it's those who arrogantly live as if they know better than God who are one day going to have to answer him. But as Job was given the right response to mediate for them, to pray for them. That's our role as well. Well, David's going to stop recording.